This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Journalist Bob Woodward's new book, Plan of Attack, is an inside account of the Bush administration's planning for the invasion of Iraq. The detailed narrative reveals intense battles among top policymakers and asserts Bush decided to invade at a time when the administration was still publicly committed to diplomacy. In researching the book, Woodward interviewed President Bush on the record for 3.5 hours last December. He also interviewed more than 75 other officials on a background basis, with the understanding he could use the information they provided, but would not reveal their names in the book. Since the book was published, several key players have taken issue with some of its accounts, and in doing so revealed that they spoke to Woodward. Secretary of State Colin Powell insists he was never out of the loop on policy decisions, and says he believes going to war was the right thing to do. Powell says he and other officials spoke to Woodward on instructions from the White House. Bob Woodward has been a reporter and editor at the Washington Post for 33 years and has written 9 nonfiction bestsellers. Woodward and Carl Bernstein's reporting for the Post about the Watergate scandal was a key factor in the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Their book about the scandal, All the President's Men, became a movie. Woodward's last book, Bush at War, was also a behind-the-scenes look at the Bush administration, focusing on its response to the September 11th attacks. Bob Woodward, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How soon after the September 11th attacks did President Bush ask Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to develop plans to invade Iraq?
Exactly 72 days after 9/11. It was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, November 21st, and he took him aside after an NSC meeting, asked to speak to him privately, went into a little cubbyhole office, closed the door, and said, "What have you got in terms of plans for a war with Iraq?" And the president asked that it be kept secret and other people not be told at that moment, though they were told soon thereafter. And if you know Rumsfeld, once you push the button on his console to do something, he went into overdrive.
Then he goes to Tommy Franks, the general who's in the middle of fighting a war in Afghanistan, who has a rather colorful reaction to this request.
Yes, he is astounded, and there are a few words which we won't mention on the air because Frank said, you know, we're busy. I can't believe that this is being proposed. But then he settled down quickly and began a very secret, very intense effort to come up with plans. And over the next really 14, 15 months, they changed the whole concept a couple of times and made it faster and made it more lethal.
And Rumsfeld gets right down into the details of this kind of planning.
Yes, totally. He insists on assumptions that they list exactly what they're assuming, and in the briefing they gave the president right after Christmas of 2001 down at his ranch in Crawford, they listed 14 or so assumptions to make it clear that they would need certain support in the region, they would need certain conditions, they would need certain munitions, a very detailed analysis of what they needed from others in order to carry out the war.
You know, Rumsfeld comes off in this account, and you spend quite a bit of time on the war planning effort, and
yes,
he comes across as an impressive figure, at least in his intellectual rigor. I mean, demanding, as you said, that commanders examine the assumptions of their plans. But I wonder, did he ever anticipate the consequences of this invasion, what they would do if they won?
Well, that's a very good question, and of course, Rumsfeld and Franks were so tied up in planning for the war, and you can understand if that's on your desk and it looks like it's going to happen, it's the issue you deal with each day, and they wanted to protect our forces and make sure that the intelligence matched where they were going to go, where they were going to bomb, and so forth. And I think the aftermath planning, I mean, not that I think, the record shows, got a back seat, and to a certain extent it fell through the cracks. In one way, you know, it clearly should not have. On the other hand, when you're engaged in a war and you are going to risk lives of your military people, you want to make sure it gets full attention.
Secretary of State Colin Powell, as planning proceeded through 2002 for an invasion of Iraq, the Secretary of State Colin Powell had a lot of reservations, but he didn't have the kind of close relationship to the president that Dick Cheney, the vice president, and Secretary Rumsfeld had. There came a point in, I guess, in August of 2002 where he, I guess, sort of insisted on a private meeting with the president. And what did he tell President Bush?
That's right, a two-hour meeting of extraordinary. Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor, was there. But Powell had written out notes, and the theme was, if you go to war with Iraq, you'll own the place after invading, and that the consequences could be very serious to the region. It would suck out all of the oxygen and attention in foreign affairs and elsewhere. It was a pretty dramatic presentation about the downside of war. The president quite naturally said, what do you think I should do? And Powell said, try to build a coalition. This led to the president's eventual decision in September of 2002 to go to the UN and make that famous speech saying, we're going to either, if the UN won't disarm Iraq, the United States will, and if necessary, we'll go alone.
Did Colin Powell actually use the phrase, the Pottery Barn rules?
He and his deputy, Rich Armitage, used that regularly. And I learned recently the columnist from the New York Times, Tom Friedman, had used this phrase in lots of his columns and speeches with reference to Iraq, that if you break it, you own it. The presentation to the president was more along the lines of, these are the consequences, this is the impact on the economy of the Middle East, this is the risk. It was really a very long discussion of the downsides.
But Powell, who didn't have quite the close relationship with the president as, say, Vice President Cheney, he regarded Cheney as someone who, I believe you said, had a fever for invading Iraq.
That's correct.
Was he right?
Well, that's his conclusion, and a very strong one. And there's evidence that Cheney was focused, if not obsessed, on Iraq and al-Qaeda and the threat, very real, unrealized at this point, that al-Qaeda was somehow connected to Iraq and that they would get a nuclear weapon or a chemical or biological weapon and detonate it in this country. And, of course, that would have been a catastrophe. So Cheney was focused on that and with a kind of always returning to it in discussions and meetings. I asked the president specifically, I said, some of the people in your war cabinet feel that Cheney had this fever, and the president disagreed and said Cheney's very steady and is not the sort of person who displays a kind of fanaticism. But others saw it, including the president's chief political advisor, Karl Rove, who believed that Cheney had a fever on this subject.
I believe you used the words a powerful steamrolling force to describe Cheney's role and plan for the invasion.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the chronology and so much of the story and the detail is as the war planning, the CIA covert activity and the diplomacy proceeded, and you see that Cheney, for instance, when the president decided to go to the UN and seek new weapons inspection resolutions. Cheney was almost a mocking of it, just felt it was not going to work, that it was a waste of time, and kept pinging on that issue. And his dissent and the force with which he felt that this would not work, diplomacy would not work, that you had to be tough, you had to go kick Saddam out.
How bad did relations between Secretary of State Powell and Vice President Cheney get?
Pretty bad. There's been some discussion that I was saying that they barely spoke. That's not what I said. What the book reports is that Cheney and Powell essentially have these two world views. Powell's being much more cautious, much more oriented toward diplomacy. Cheney's much more of the hardline, tough guy, particularly on Saddam, believing that Saddam had fooled the world for decades, and it was time to change the regime, and the only effective way to do that was militarily. The differences were so severe that they could really not sit down and talk about it. No lunch, no conversation, never. And certainly at NSC meetings, they talk. I'm sure they will be trotted out soon, and we will see them laughing and showing that they're part of the Bush team. But the river of disagreement runs very deep between them.
Is it true that people on Powell's staff referred to Cheney and his deputy and some of the people at Defense as the Gestapo group?
That Powell did. Is the little Gestapo. And that tells you again the level of emotion and anger and conviction, and to, you know, even casually call somebody that is pretty serious. Yesterday, Apollo was asked about this and said that he did not remember saying that. But that he did call Doug Feith to apologize. He was the one, the undersecretary for policy, who was specifically fingered by Powell as running this Gestapo office.
My guest is Bob Woodward. His new book is Plan of Attack. What was the state of CIA intelligence about Iraq at the time of the September 11th attacks?
Not very good. There is a CIA officer, you know, one of the heroes of this to a certain extent, if there are any heroes, named Saul, who was in charge of Iraqi covert operations for the CIA. They called this group within the CIA the House of Broken Toys because they had been so ineffective over the last several decades in doing anything to oust Saddam. Saul took over and assessed the human sources, and as he reported to the White House, he said, we have got human sources in Iraq, and I can count them on one hand and still pick my nose, meaning there were four. And those four human sources were not at the center of Saddam's regime, not in his security service or his intelligence service, very much on the remote outskirts. So Saul did a rather clear-eyed analysis of the situation and said, look, the CIA is not going to be able to overthrow Saddam in a coup. What we can do is support a military invasion. This then led to a proposal, and finally the president on February 16th, 2002, signing a secret order to the CIA to conduct covert operations to support a military operation to overthrow Saddam. And so what that did, it made it very, very clear that the CIA was supporting, whether intentionally or unintentionally, a military invasion because they wanted to get the job done.
You have a very colorful description of a CIA operative. I believe his code name was Tim, wasn't it?
His nickname.
The nickname that
Tim.
You gave him, who goes into Iraq through Turkey with suitcases, trunks of $100 bills to begin building alliances and intelligence infrastructure.
That's right. He goes into the Kurdish area of Iraq. Remember, this is still Saddam's country, though the Kurds have relative autonomy in this region. And Tim takes, again, this is somebody who, if you were going to make a movie, somebody out of central casting to be a CIA covert team leader, he would fit the bill, spoke Arabic, came from one of the stations in the region, paid about, by the CIA, $150 a day, And he went in there with, at one point, $35 million in cash to set up a base, to make contacts, which they did with a religious group that opposed Saddam. And they had members of this group very close to Saddam in the security service, in the military. And Tim and his team literally recruited 87 spies inside Iraq. They were given the code name Rockstars. And these Rockstars reported on phones to Tim, and he relayed their intelligence to headquarters and to General Franks.
You write that there was so much money that he was distributing to both intelligence sources as well as allies among the Kurds and others, that at some point somebody told him, hey, you got to get some $10 and $20 bills in here, right?
That's right, because they had created in this area such hyperinflation through the $100 bill, no one had change. And the Kurdish leader went to Tim and said, Tim, please, bring us some fives and tens and twenties so we can make change, because a cup of coffee now costs $100.
Well, one of the things the CIA was doing, apart from assisting in a potential invasion, was to figure out the state of Saddam's armed forces and the location and or existence of weapons of mass destruction. As the Bush administration was considering war, it was also developing information about that. You note that in the fall of 2002, there was a national intelligence estimate developed. And President Bush got a personal briefing in December at which he wanted to know from, I guess, CIA Director George Tenet and his people, what we knew about Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction. What was the president told in that briefing?
What happened, they published the national intelligence estimate, with top secret. It was given to administration figures and to some people on the intelligence committee in Congress, the Senate and the House. And it said categorically, Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, period, no qualification. And then if you read the whole estimate, you see that the information is quite weak, and they kind of dance back as you go through the details. But it is this very strong assertion, which went to Congress, and of course Congress passed the resolutions authorizing Bush to use the military to change the regime in Iraq. By December, there was still some doubt about whether this was absolutely sure. The president wanted to make a public case, and so the Saturday before Christmas, December 21st, he asked for a presentation in the Oval Office, which was made by Tenet's deputy, John McLaughlin, using all the secret intelligence that they had, the satellite photos, the communications intercepts, the human sources. And after the president listened to this, he said, nice try. And the president told me it was just not something ready for public presentation. And he told the group in the Oval Office, the president did, said, this is not something that would convince Joe Public. And the president turned to George Tenet, the CIA director who was there, and said, George, you said we have a strong case. What have you got here? What's going on? Doesn't compute. And Tenet rose up and said, don't worry, it's a slam dunk. The president, when I asked about this and asked others who were there, and the president specifically said this was very important in convincing him that they had a case to make. And, of course, this case was then in early February, about a month and a half before the war, presented to the UN by Colin Powell, of all people.
So it sounds as if when Bush asked for this briefing, it wasn't that he wanted to satisfy himself that the weapons were there. It was more a matter of making the public case to justify an invasion.
Yes, that's exactly right, that Joe Public would not buy it.
Throughout 2002, the Pentagon was developing detailed plans for an invasion of Iraq. I'm wondering, did the administration hide that from the public?
Well, there were leaks, and the leaks, it was almost one plan or idea for invading Iraq leaked each day that Condi Rice finally said to the president, well, one benefit of these leaks is, because some of them were contradictory, is that Saddam must be entirely confused. There was very, as I say, intense planning going on, and in the spring of 2002, the president said, somewhat dismissively a number of times, well, there are no war plans for Iraq on my desk. I guess literally that's true. Every time I've been in the Oval Office, the president's desk is clear. There's nothing on his desk. But it gave the impression that there was nothing actively going on, and he should have stuck to some of his earlier characterizations where he said, I'm holding my options very close to my vest, and I'm not going to discuss them. But the statement, there are no war plans on my desk, gave a sense that they're not doing anything. And you look back at what was going on and that statement, and they don't square very well.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with veteran journalist Bob Woodward. His new book, Plan of Attack, is an inside account of the Bush administration's preparations for war in Iraq. Before the break, Woodward was describing debate within the administration over the quality of its information on Iraq's weapons programs. There was also an issue of what the administration should say publicly about weapons of mass destruction. I know that Colin Powell was concerned about whether they really had facts and hard information as opposed to inferences and judgments.
And he spent a lot of time going over the intelligence and bought in and accepted it. There was a certain logic to it, but it was not ironclad. It was not proof, and it was presented by the administration and Powell as if it were proof. There is an interesting moment in the book when the head of the National Security Agency, which does all of the communications intercepts worldwide for the governments, the biggest intelligence agency we have, much bigger than the CIA, General Hayden, is doing dishes with his wife one night, and she's asking about intelligence and WMD, and he said to her the following, well, if it were fact, it wouldn't be intelligence. And in a sense, that should have been shared with the world, that intelligence is not fact. It is not certainty. It is inference. It involves a certain amount of guesswork sometimes. It certainly amounts to a lot of judgment. There is, when you look at the evidence and so forth, and the fact that Saddam had had weapons in the past and had used them, it seemed almost for sure. But instead of saying it seems almost for sure, they said it's for sure. And I think that is a mistake that will live for years, if not even longer.
Bob Woodward, a lot of attention has come to a meeting that Vice President Cheney and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld held with the Saudi ambassador in January 2003. I believe General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, was also there. Now, this was a meeting 2 months before the administration publicly committed to war. What kind of information were they there to share with the Saudi ambassador?
Well, the president had told Condi Rice at this point that he decided on war. He had told Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld that he had decided on war. Rumsfeld felt very strongly that you reach a point of no return when you tell a foreign country, this is going to happen. We're going to go to war, and we want your support. We want to use your territory, your equipment, your intelligence, whatever. And they, with the president's permission, Cheney and Rumsfeld called in Prince Mandar, the Saudi ambassador, and with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as you said, and briefed him on the war plan, top secret, not to be shown to any foreign national, but it was, in this case, Bandar had extraordinary, surprising access to the Bush White House, and Don Rumsfeld looked at the map after it had been explained by General Myers, and said, "This is going to happen. You can take it to the bank." And Bandar was a little skeptical because he'd known of lots of saber rattling in Iraq before, and said, "So this means Saddam will be finished." And Cheney said, "When we do this, Saddam is toast." And at the end, Bandar said, "Well, this is all well and good, the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense, but I have to carry back a message from the President." So they set up a meeting with the President, and the President told Bandar that the message you got 2 days earlier from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Rumsfeld and the Vice President is my message. You can carry that message. It's a decision. Now, the White House, I believe, embarrassed because 2 months later or 6 weeks later, the President was saying publicly, "Well, we have not decided on military action," is trying to backpedal on this. I went over it in detail with the President, and Rumsfeld is on the record about it, and I believe the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs said my account is essentially accurate. This decision was conveyed. Now, in the book, Andy Card, who's the White House Chief of Staff, makes the point that this is not an irrevocable decision, that you could march back. The consequences might be very large, but they could be managed. The National Security Advisor, Condi Rice, then, after Bandar had been briefed, told the President, "We better call Colin Powell in and tell him."
So Colin Powell at this point did not know of this internal commitment to go to war?
Well, he knew about the plan. There's been much discussion that I'm saying he didn't know about the plan in the book. If you've gone through it, he's in on the military planning at all points. He does not know that there has been this decision. So the President called him in and said, "I'm going to go to war," and explicitly said, "Will you be with me?" And said to Colin Powell, the former Joint Chiefs chairman, 35 years in the Army, President said, "Time to get your to put your war uniform on." Powell left the meeting concluding he's going to do it, that the President is going to go to war. I've done this reporting for 32 years now, and I guess the White House and the administration had decided that this is a truth they don't want out, and so they are trying to say, and Powell has been saying, "Well, this really wasn't a decision meeting."
But the narrative as you see it is the decision was made in January. It was communicated to the Saudi ambassador, and then Condoleezza Rice says, "Hey, you've got to notify the Secretary of State of what the ambassador to a foreign country now knows."
That's right. And it's not as if the sourcing on this is weak. I interviewed the President, and I asked him pointedly. I went through the sequence as I understood it after going round and round. The President said, quote, "It sounds like you got it right." And the President said the meeting was short. I checked some records from some people at the White House. It was a 12-minute meeting. And the President said this to me: "There wasn't much debate. It looks like we're headed to war." Now, there's, you know, that's what the President said on the record. I've interviewed, Powell now has acknowledged that I interviewed him. He said a couple of times on the phone, I checked my records, and I interviewed him at length on the telephone, tape recorded with Powell's permission, six times for this book. One time, August 4th, 2003, yielding 26 pages of transcript. August 13th, September 16th, November 30th, 32 pages of transcript.
And the terms of those interviews were what?
That it's on background and that I can use the material.
Right.
And I'm not going to say, what I specifically got from him, but it would be irresponsible of me as a journalist to have information that I'm going to put in the book and not ask him about it in detail.
What do you think is the larger significance of the fact that the administration went to such lengths to brief and reassure the Saudi ambassador?
Well, they needed Saudi Arabia. The Iraq-Saudi border, 500 miles. The relations between Saudi Arabia and the administration are incredibly close. The president's father considers Prince Bandar almost a member of his family. So I think there's a lot going on here in terms of personal relations. We need the Saudis for the oil that they supply each day to this country. If that were cut off or drastically reduced, the economic impact in this country would be staggering. At the same time, the Saudis need us because we're such a big market, and they want us to have a healthy economy, so we will consume lots of their oil, to put it bluntly.
Did the administration get any assurances from the Saudis about oil production and oil prices as it related to a potential war in Iraq?
Yes. On the day war was decided, officially, or General Franks was ordered to go to war, this is March 19th, 2003, there is a briefing in the White House by the energy people telling the president that the Saudis will up production about up to 2 million barrels a day during the war to make up for any possible shortfall. And they did this, in fact.
Was this done to help the White House politically?
No, I think this was to help the war effort, which the Saudis supported and did not want the war to have a negative impact on the American economy. I also write in the book that Prince Bandar, which the other night he did confirm specifically that the Saudis hoped to manage oil availability, which is price because it's very sensitive to the production levels, that they hope to do this in the 10-month period leading up to the election, and that Bandar knew that the condition of the American economy is very important to the election.
The administration had enormous costs as it built up for war, improving airfields, installing pipelines, and I believe the figure $700 million is mentioned. It had to do this without arousing the suspicion of Congress about all this activity.
Or the public.
Or the public. Where did they get the money?
Well, there was a big appropriation for Afghanistan, and my reporting in the White House shows that the president signed off on a memo the end of July 2002 approving these projects, and they did not want to send up a flare and let Congress or the public know that this was going on. I asked the president about this, and again, he confirmed it. They are now saying, well, part of the money, yes, part of the money, no. The point and the significance of this is the Congress didn't know. And whether the appropriations were so large and given with such a blank check is kind of irrelevant. The job of Congress is to know and to monitor where money is going, and if the executive branch is going to embark on secret war planning and prepare itself and improve its position and spend taxpayers' money, you would think that someone or some of the leadership in Congress or someone would have some idea that this was going on, and it seems to be, based on what My reporting shows, and what has come out since, that this took place totally under the radar.
I guess it's a little unclear whether this represents an illegal diversion of funds. Well, I mean, was this money targeted for Afghanistan and then
well,
pulled out of the wrong kitty?
It was an appropriation, as I understand it, gave lots of money to General Franks, who was overseeing at the time the war in Afghanistan and doing the secret planning for the Iraq War. And this is in places where, for instance, improving runways and airfields, that they could say, well, that's really for Afghanistan. In fact, it was for a potential Iraq war. And it's one of those things where there's so much money. I am not going to reach a legal judgment about it. But what interested me, what struck me, is that so much money was being spent in secret, and whatever the arrangements were, proper or improper, Congress was kept in the dark. And I think you can make an argument that the Constitution and other traditions and laws make it pretty clear that they should know more. That, for instance, on the covert action to support a military invasion of Iraq, Bush allocated $200 million for this. This had to be approved secretly by the Congress, and they cut the amount down to $189 million. So there were people in Congress, though pledged to keep it secret, who knew that this covert action was going on. In the case of preparing the military, this part of it, as best I can tell, and I certainly don't know what I don't know, no one knew in Congress.
There's a point in the book where you describe Bush meeting with an Iraqi exile group, in which he says, referring to the coming war, and this was a direct quote, "I believe out of this will come peace between Israel and the Palestinians."
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, where did that come from?
I think it's this idea that if you set up more of a model of democracy in the Middle East, in addition to Israel, if you have an Arab state that's democratic, that it will spread. This is the Bush optimism. This is the Bush a very grandiose view of what he thinks he can do as president, and that's an expression of that. I was struck by that also.
How would you rate his sort of capacity for understanding the subtleties of issues like Israel and the Palestinians and the difficulties of building Iraq? I mean, it's sort of no secret. A lot of people regard this president as somebody who believes in a few simple ideas. I mean, you've talked to him. You had some long, serious conversations about him. I mean, did he grasp the subtleties of this material?
Well, I think he basically understands it, whether all of the subtleties and nuances, I really don't know. I don't think I understand the subtleties and nuances of the Middle East or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He is, and in one of the earlier interviews, he said, "I'm a gut player." He works by instincts. He's very much oriented towards, okay, there's a problem. Somebody tells him who knows a lot about it, and what he says basically is fix it, get it done. I trust you to do it. It is delegation, and when you go through this book, he is the idea that somehow Cheney was running things, or Cheney was making decisions, or Bush was not involved, I think is dispelled pretty completely. He was on top of this. At the same time, it's his war, it's his decision, and in the end, it defines his first term as president as much as anything. One of the common themes I found in talking to people is if you want to understand Bush and what he values and cares about and what makes him tick, look at this decision. And I think it obviously is about a war decision, but it's also about his character. Character is action, and this is what he acted on.
Well, Bob Woodward, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Journalist Bob Woodward. His new book is Plan of Attack.